From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
This has been a day of political drama and brinksmanship over legislation giving the government broad powers to eavesdrop.
Republicans walked off the floor and out of the Capitol today.
They left the House chamber to protest the Democrats' refusal to renew the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Law.
On Thursday, the Republican leadership of the House of Representatives staged quite the media moment, a dramatic walkout from the floor of the House in protest of an impending vote to hold two White House officials in contempt of Congress. To Republican Minority Leader John Boehner, this was no more than a stunt, cheap theatrics, two-bit political grandstanding. Not the walkout, mind you, in which the GOP caucus stalked out like the frat boys in Animal House, but the contempt resolution itself. Here's Boehner.
If the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act were to expire, Americans will be at risk. Americans want us to protect them. They want us to go after the terrorists. But we have to give our intelligence officials the tools to be able to do it.
America at risk? Well, that's for sure. Not only from bearded Islamists cowering in caves, but also by white men in red neckties who, in the name of national security, for 6.5 years, have eroded the civil liberties at the heart of our Constitution. In that way, Thursday's walkout was a paradox within a photo op within a civics lesson. The pretext was the Democratic leadership's refusal to vote on the extension of broad eavesdropping authority temporarily given the administration a year ago. That authority expired Friday, although the government retains the ability to monitor al-Qaeda and other established threats and also to seek new wiretaps via court order as necessary. The Senate had voted Tuesday to extend the law and to immunize U.S. phone companies from any lawsuit challenging their cooperation with the government. But some House Democrats smelled in that immunity deal a cover-up of previous administration excesses, to say nothing of giving the government spying tools worthy of a police state. And so the law was poised to lapse at week's end. This led to charges that the irresponsible Democrats were lowering the drawbridge for enemies who hate our freedom.
At this moment, somewhere in the world, terrorists are planning new attacks on our country. Their goal is to bring destruction to our shores that will make September the 11th pale by comparison. To carry out their plans, they must communicate with each other. They must recruit operatives, and they must share information. The lives of countless Americans depend on our ability to monitor these communications.
Of course, the president never mentions the freedoms already stolen, like the freedom not to be spied on and the constitutional freedom to hold the government accountable for its conduct. And thus the irony of Thursday's walkout. Had Boehner and company hung around, they'd have gotten to witness the Constitution in action, checks, balances, and all. The House voted to hold President Bush's chief of staff, Josh Bolton, and former White House counsel Harriet Myers in contempt for refusing to testify as to whether Justice Department officials conspired with the White House to illegally fire politically suspect U.S. attorneys. The administration claims executive privilege and refuses to provide subpoenaed evidence or sworn testimony to Congress. Could it be that the GOP walkout had nothing to do with spying authority at all? Maybe it was, in media parlance, just a bit of counter-programming. Or, in other words, changing the subject.
War stories can burnish a nation's self-image. Lots of World War II battles come to mind. Or tarnish it, as in the My Lai massacre of civilians by American soldiers in Vietnam 40 years ago. The war in Iraq also yields stories. One of the most damaging involves a reported massacre in the town of Haditha in the fall of 2005. In fact, what happened there has been compared often in the media to My Lai. In Haditha, the story goes, after a Marine Lance Corporal was killed by a roadside bomb, his comrades went on a rampage. Representative John Murtha, Pennsylvania Democrat and Vietnam vet, publicly condemned the incident as a massacre of two dozen men, women, and children in their homes. In December 2006, the Marine Corps filed charges against 8 Marines, one of the most significant criminal cases against U.S. troops during this war. Later, eyewitnesses and video evidence indicated that there was, in fact, significant insurgent activity that day, and small arms fire was directed at the Marines from some houses. On Tuesday, the PBS documentary series Frontline takes a closer look at the deaths of those civilians. Were they killed in revenge, or were they, in reality, casualties of the rules of engagement? Arun Roth wrote, directed, and produced the hour called Rules of Engagement. He says that the first military press release about the incident claimed that many of those civilians were killed by that roadside bomb. And that's how it was reported at first.
There was a gentleman in Haditha who videotaped much of the aftermath and decided that he was going to get the real story of this out. He went to Time Magazine's Baghdad correspondent, Tim McGurk, gave him the videotape. McGurk was shocked and horrified. It is horrible. You see bodies of dead women and children that have been killed by grenades and by rifle fire. You know, he went back then and looked at the original Marine press release, which claimed all these people had been killed by a roadside bomb, and sort of put two and two together and thought, well, these people are actually – they're in their pajamas. Iraqis don't wander around in their pajamas early in the morning. There's something here which is not quite right. And the people who had given him the tape told him, no, it was Marines who had done this.
How did the Marines react to McGurk's story?
Well, the initial Marine that Tim McGurk talked to essentially kind of blew him off, said, I can't believe you're buying this. This is clearly al-Qaeda and Iraq propaganda. But, you know, come on out here and we'll give you a presentation about what actually happened that day. McGurk did not go to Haditha. His editor didn't feel it was safe enough to go. So he went to a commander in Baghdad and took this tape to him and took some of the interviews that he'd done over the phone with Iraqis from Haditha. And they said, yeah, this seems like it's enough for an investigation.
And then McGurk wrote his story?
Yeah, McGurk's piece came out in March of 2006. And the initial story that McGurk wrote, which contains all these basic facts, the accusations of execution-style killings, etc., did not get very much attention from the rest of the media when it first came out.
Until Representative John Murtha picked it up.
He did, and it was in June of 2006 at a press conference where, at the end of a long litany of complaints about how the war was going in Iraq, he let drop this line about what had happened in Haditha, and he said it's actually much worse than what was reported in Time magazine. They killed these people in cold blood, that there was no firefight that day, and that the investigation will reveal that. That was when people really started to take notice. Other papers picked up on the story, and all these comparisons started to fly around. Murtha himself really picked it up at that point and went on all the various, Sunday morning shows and repeated this charge over and over again. You know, he was doing this in the context of trying to convince the administration and America that we needed to bring U.S. forces home. You know, this is the sort of pressure that our forces were under, that was driving them to basically commit war crimes.
So do you have a problem with the way that the media portrayed the incident? I mean, soldiers were deeply angered by the death of their beloved Lance Corporal Miguel Terrazas. They did kick down doors. They did shoot women and children and elderly people, right?
The complaints that I've heard from the Marines who are very angry about how this has played out in the media have been a couple of things. One is that there wasn't enough vetting of what Murtha was saying at the time. I mean, it's a difficult thing to do because Murtha, you know, he's a former Marine. Obviously, he has connections to intelligence, to the military. He's citing his own sources saying that. So you can understand why that would be a big deal to reporters to have this guy who is a Vietnam veteran, a former Marine himself. The bigger complaint that I think they have is the subsequent attention that the media devoted to the story since the initial charges started to echo around and the sort of coverage that there's been of the legal proceedings since then. And as we've seen, a lot of the charges have been dismissed, have been reduced. In the case of one of the Marines who supposedly executed several Iraqis in cold blood, the charges against him have been completely dismissed. As far as the courts are concerned, he is not guilty.
So you buy the military's complaint that the media, who were so quick to accuse, were not willing to hang around for the real investigation.
If you do a nexus search and look at the coverage of Haditha back when the charges were first announced, even before that when Murtha was making the rounds on the talk shows, there definitely was a lot more coverage of the case than there was as these details have come out in dribs and drabs over the course of the hearings, which have largely been in the Marines' favor.
So it seems like what you've got here is your classic first draft of history situation. You have the initial reports in the media. You don't have very many follow-up reports, except perhaps this documentary of yours. Is there any chance that we'll ever think of Haditha as anything other than an act of revenge, a massacre?
I think it's going to be difficult to really erase that notion. And we may get there to a certain extent, I think, in America. There are a lot of people who are very passionate about this cause with the Marines. So there are a lot of military bloggers and people who follow this story that within those communities, they've reported a lot of the stuff that we've just talked about. And, you know, hopefully with this film, more people will be aware of that. I think the bigger damage is likely to be outside our borders. The Iraqis that we spoke to, I told them about what had happened with these trials and how the charges had gradually been diminished bit by bit. And not surprisingly, they were very cynical about it. They figured, well, this is the Marines judging the Marines. And especially given all the pre-existing PR problems that have to do with this war, it's going to be very hard for people not to associate Haditha with a massacre by Marines in the rest of the world, and especially in the Arab world.
But is it fundamentally wrong when the rules of engagement that currently govern the behavior of American soldiers in Iraq creates an environment where so many civilians can be killed? Maybe the first draft is not so wrong after all.
Well, I mean, I think we can certainly say wrong in certain crucial aspects of it. But you get to an interesting point. The defense is arguing that there is at least a certain amount of confusion over the rules of engagement, which is leading to these situations, not that the Marines themselves exercised poor judgment. They had sent in this unit who had been in Fallujah that were considered a blunt force instrument. This is how they clear houses. You don't distinguish friendlies from foes. When a house is declared hostile, you clear the house. That's blunt force. If you put a blunt force instrument into a situation like that where it's more complicated, where civilians are blended in with the insurgents, civilians are going to die.
Arun, thank you very much.
My pleasure, Brooke.
Arun Roth is the director, writer, and producer of the frontline documentary Rules of Engagement that premieres on PBS stations on Tuesday.
This is On the Media from NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. What's the deal with reporters using inappropriate words that begin with the letter P? This week, Time magazine's Mark Halperin had to apologize for using a not-for-primetime P word, which we won't repeat on the radio. And, of course, there's MSNBC's David Schuster.
But doesn't it seem like Chelsea's sort of being pimped out in some weird sort of way?
No. She's there. Listen, if she didn't want to be there, she would.
That was Schuster on February 7th. Here he was on the 8th.
I used a phrase that was inappropriate. And I apologize to the Clinton family, the Clinton campaign, and all of you who were justifiably offended.
Tempers have since cooled. Clinton has agreed to take part in an MSNBC debate she initially threatened to boycott, and the suspended Schuster will be back on the air next week. But was the uproar really over the use of the word pimp? Rachel Sklar is media editor at the liberal blog The Huffington Post. She's also a regular commentator on CNN, Fox News, and MSNBC. She says there's more to the Schuster blooper than just a poor choice of words.
There's nobody who thinks that Hillary Clinton had her daughter Chelsea go out and offer her body to superdelegates for her campaign coffers. That's for sure.
What has it come to mean, if not, you know, actual prostitution?
Well, it's just, I guess, a hip term for promoting something, advertising something, putting something out there. And in that respect, you know, Chelsea was clearly an advocate for her mother. But I don't think there's anybody who really thinks that that was an appropriate way to call it on television.
Let's just put aside for a moment whether Schuster's remarks were offensive and inappropriate, as NBC says in its statement about his suspension. Let's talk about the underlying question. Is it in any way unseemly for a political candidate to enlist his or her children to go out on the stump or otherwise promote their candidacies? Isn't that standard operating procedure?
Yes, it absolutely is. And the reason that I thought it was such a jarring statement, I actually reacted more to that aspect than I did to the language used, because you've got Sarah Huckabee, who is her father's field manager, I think, Meghan McCain, who is blogging on behalf of her father, Kate Edwards, who was out on the stump, and of course, the 10 gazillion Romney boys. So really, Chelsea Clinton being out and about would not shock anyone.
It seems that what's happened here has more to do with history than it has to do with the particulars of Schuster's remarks, especially a history recently between Hillary Clinton and MSNBC. Tell us about that background, please.
Chris Matthews, the day after the New Hampshire primary and Hillary Clinton's victory, made the comment that she was basically where she was, quote, because her husband messed around. And Media Matters, which gets its teeth into these things and really shakes its head furiously, generated post after post about things that Chris Matthews had said, things that other people on MSNBC had said, comments from Joe Scarborough, comments from Tucker Carlson, very specific and discreet situations, but when you put them all together, did seem to call for some sort of response. And so Chris Matthews responded to the kerfuffle, and there the matter lay until this.
Now, you mentioned Media Matters, the liberal media criticism organization, shaking its head. At the same time, we've had the spectacle of Bill Clinton shaking his finger at the press for its treatment of his wife and her candidacy. To what extent do you believe that this incident has been informed by all of the bad blood that has been generated over the years between the Clintons and the national press?
Well, it's so funny that you mentioned the Bill Clinton finger wag, because all of the characterizations of Bill Clinton on the campaign trail from New Hampshire to South Carolina that characterized him as being angry or frustrated and actually did invoke that finger wagging image. From what I saw, he never actually was that ruffled and certainly didn't break out the finger. Going to your larger question, yes, there's no question that there is history here. And Paul Krugman had a really great column in the New York Times recently breaking it down to what he called Clinton rules, which is basically the default assumption of the media that anytime a Clinton does something, it's usually with ill intent. And you sort of have seen this in this situation. I got to say, a little bit surprised at the backlash that Hillary Clinton has gotten following the release of her letter to NBC News President Steve Kappas, in which she said that a half-hearted apology and a suspension wasn't enough. A lot of people took that to mean that she was calling for David Schuster to be fired. And so there was plenty of outrage over that. But I did not take that to be the meaning of the letter, and nowhere in the letter did it say that.
To the extent that there has been backlash over Senator Clinton's reaction to this episode, I'm assuming that it's rooted in the question of whether this was, in fact, an outraged mother putting her motherhood first and her candidacy second, or just political opportunism, and whether it was, some sort of ginned-up controversy over a weird but, you know, ultimately innocuous question.
I find it useful and instructive when this type of episode occurs to play a little mind game where I swap out Clinton and I swap in Obama. And I imagine, would the press coverage be exactly the same? I think we can probably all agree that if someone had made that comment about Obama, there would be an outcry. No one would rush to the assumption that there was some sort of cold, calculating, opportunistic attempt to exploit the situation, quite in the same way that happens with Hillary Clinton. I don't think I need to prove that. I think it just sort of is. You've got the twin tensions of this campaign here in this remark, because it's a sexist situation and overtone and question with respect to Hillary and Chelsea, and it would be a racist overtone and insinuation and question with respect to Obama. And I want to be really clear here that I am extrapolating to the reaction. I am not imputing anything to David Schuster other than the fact that at one moment in time, he thought he was being hip. That's it.
All right, Rachel. Well, thank you so much.
Well, thank you.
Rachel Sklar is media editor at the Huffington Post. The Writers Guild of America voted this week to end a 100-day strike that left many TV shows in limbo and many TV viewers in search of other entertainment options. The Guild settled its bitter dispute with the Alliance of Motion Picture and Television Producers, reaching a compromise over internet revenue sharing. But was it worth it? Many media outlets reported that writers will eventually get 2% of the gross ad money from TV shows streamed on the web, but look closely. The, quote, gross is in fact fixed at $40,000, at least for this contract, which means the writer gets $800 even if the actual gross turns out to be higher. Kim Masters covers the entertainment business for NPR. She says the Writers Guild has successfully hyped this deal as a victory, and both the Guild members and the press were eager to play along.
What they're getting, as you pointed out, is 2% of $40,000 because the deal stipulates that the ad revenue will be, whatever it really is, $40,000 for the purposes of this contract. And as you point out, that comes out to a few hundred dollars. What they got is they have now theoretically got a chance to look at the books and see how much ad revenue really is thrown off when an episode is streamed on the internet. And then next time they will try to bargain and make that a more meaningful, if it turns out that $40,000 is low, they'll try to make it a more meaningful actual percentage.
So at a minimum, they've set a precedent for the next contract cycle in three years.
Yeah, it's like a conceptual precedent. It's not really a percentage. But the word percentage appears in the deal. It's a little bit of a sleight of hand. Even when they get paid for the streaming video, there is a period of about 3 weeks where the studios just get to stream those videos without paying them anything. And you would imagine that if The Office is broadcast and you missed it and you wanted to watch it online, you're probably going to watch it in that window. So there are all sorts of exceptions all across the board. The deal is incredibly complicated and hardly one where you can say, yes, the writers won. But, you know, they've spun it.
There has been so much turbulence in broadcast television, mostly having to do with audience fragmentation, that seems to have been vastly exacerbated by the writers' strike. What happened to viewers?
During the strike, there were increased DVD rentals, a little pop in that. But online is where viewers appear to be headed, and it's also where the advertising dollars appear to be headed. And the networks are grappling with this. They don't have any answers, and they're flailing. And that's partly, I think the feeling that that is inevitable is why the strike was so bitterly fought, because the feeling is that's where it's all headed. It's all headed to the internet. And what will business be like then if, as now, the networks can't command the same kind of ad dollars from the internet as they do for broadcasting things over the air?
On this show and elsewhere, I've talked quite a bit about the chaos that's going on in the world of entertainment. And you've just put your finger on a big part of it. You know, who will be able to fund the kind of entertainment that we've all grown accustomed to on broadcast television and cable as it gravitates towards the ultimately fragmented universe of the internet? During the writer's strike, we saw an existing trend, reality programming versus scripted sitcoms and dramas, taking over because it can be done a lot more cheaply. And I'm curious to know if you think that the networks will be producing, you know, one or two shows like Grey's Anatomy and otherwise all reality all the time.
What they're going to try to do is maintain their identity as cheaply as possible. And the one we see this in most clearly right now is NBC. NBC is putting stuff on its air, or planning to, that really would be considered cable fare. In some cases, is cable fare. They're putting on Gladiator. They're putting on all sorts of inexpensive reality. And what they've said that they want to do is to put in enough sort of high-profile stuff like Heroes or The Office that's just enough expensive stuff to get away with the really cheap stuff the rest of the time. And I think it's going to be kind of interesting to see how far can NBC, which is already in last place, push this.
You know, during the course of the strike, I kept thinking about the titanic battles between the United Auto Workers and General Motors, Ford, and Chrysler during their heyday, in which both sides were, you know, making vast amount of money, very, very high wages for very, very profitable businesses. But with the incursion of the Japanese and the Koreans and the Germans, the business of making cars in the United States began to founder. Are we witnessing a repeat of the destruction of an industry affecting, you know, both sides of it?
That is certainly the fear. The problem from the standpoint of, you know, labor relations is, on the one hand, these companies go to Wall Street and say, hey, you know, we expect to make $1 billion from the internet. And then they turn around and tell the writers and the actors, gee, we don't know what the internet is. We don't know what we're going to get from that. So they, you know, they're spinning one way on Wall Street and the other with the labor, and it becomes a difficult thing to reconcile.
Kim, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Kim Masters covers the business of entertainment for NPR. She also writes the Hollywoodland blog on Slate.com.
Let's say you're the Transportation Security Administration and you're tied for next to last place as the United States' most hated federal agency in a dead heat with the IRS. What's a relatively new agency to do? Well, the TSA has started a blog. 6 months ago, if you had a beef with the agency, you mailed a letter, left a phone message, or emailed and got no response. Today, there's something like a dialogue taking place online, and anyone can offer observations like this one recently, quote, "Too many of your TSA workers are just power-hungry morons," unquote. But amidst the abuse, something else is happening, at least according to security expert and writer Bruce Schneier. Schneier's an unlikely fan of anything TSA-related. He's publicly slammed TSA director Kip Hawley and coined terms like security theater to describe what he sees as the agency's tendency toward elaborate safety measures that provide little in the way of actual security.
What pisses the public off most is less the ridiculous rules and more that they're so capricious. There's no explanation. There's no discussion. There's no recourse. I mean, take the no-fly list. If you're on the no-fly list, you not only can't get off, but nobody will tell you that you're on. You're in this Kafka-esque nightmare.
Now, there was one early attempt at user feedback back in 2006 when a man who was angry over yet another TSA rule change wrote, "Kip Hawley is an idiot," on his clear plastic toiletry bag, and he was detained for 30 minutes and the incident got a lot of press. Are these just embarrassing for the agency or, you know, do they represent this groundswell of rage?
There's no other way to talk about it than amongst ourselves. You know, you can't go to the TSA and say, "Hey, excuse me, why are you doing this?" When you're walking through airline security, you can't complain about policy. Right? The TSA agent doesn't make policy. He's just a cog in the machine, just like you are. So there's no way to speak out against the bureaucracy other than to write or to post, or I guess in some cases to engage in civil disobedience, which is writing Kip Hawley's an idiot on your carry-on luggage.
But now we're there. We have the blog. It's called The Evolution of Security. Describe it for us.
There are five or six different TSA people who are blogging, and they talk about some of the rules. There's conversations about the liquid ban, about screening shoes. They do myth busting. Just the other week, there was a lot of chatter about laptops being confiscated by border control when you go into the country. And in some of the other blogs around the world, it turned into the TSA is doing this. So the TSA posted a message saying, "Hey, it's not us. It's this other organization." So there's that. There's also some attempt at dialogue where people are getting up and saying on the blog, "We're trying to do this. We're thinking about that. What do you, the traveling public, think?"
I was struck by the impact that the blog can have on TSA operations in various places. I'm thinking of this example of in one airport, the screeners there said you have to take out all your electronic devices and put them next to your computer in the bin, you know, your PDA, your cell phone. And those aren't in the rules. People complained to the blog and those screeners had to stop forcing people to do that.
Right. And that was in Los Angeles. And there's an example of the dialogue working. In the beginning, if you read the first post, there were two basic styles of comments. There were TSA employees who got the memo to go to the blog and say nice things. And there's everyone else who complained about the liquid ban.
But it was more than that. It was a kind of ecstasy of flaming.
Because people were really annoyed. And here's suddenly a forum where you can talk to the TSA. But it's interesting. If you look at the comments now, I mean, the blog has been going on for just under a month now. And if you look at the comments now, it's people saying things like, you know, "I thought this was a joke, but thank you for doing this." So I think the blog has gone a long way to humanize the TSA.
But Bruce, you say that some of these rules, no matter how well explained, are still dumb. Now, we've talked to many people on this show about how the U.S. tries to win hearts and minds around the world with various campaigns. And we're always told that if the underlying policies don't change, then no amount of good public relations will help win hearts and minds. Isn't the same true here?
It is. But this isn't about terrorism. This is more about the bureaucracy. So there's the larger discussion of what we as a nation should do about airport security. You know, whether it makes sense to play catch up and defend against what the bad guys did last month. You know, if we spend billions defending the airports and the terrorists go bomb shopping malls, it's arguable whether that's a good investment. So there is a much larger discussion, but that's not what the TSA blog is about. The TSA blog is about the details of people trying to get from point A to point B via plane and being frustrated at the rules or not understanding them or wanting to talk about them.
So the blog makes us feel better. Do you think that the IRS should have one?
I think every government organization should do this. I think this kind of transparency, this kind of accessibility, this kind of humanization will go a long way to making people's interactions with government smoother. And whether it's the IRS or the FDA, I think this should serve for a model for accessibility to government in the information age.
Bruce, thank you very much.
Hey, thank you.
Bruce Schneier is a security specialist and author of Beyond Fear, Thinking Sensibly About Security in an Uncertain World. You can read his entire interview with Kip Hawley at schneier.com.
Coming up, the peace symbol is 50 years old.
And we got the exclusive interview. This is On the Media from NPR.
Support for On the Media comes from the Kauffman Foundation of Kansas City, the foundation of entrepreneurship, on the web at kauffman.org. The John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, helping to build a more just future for the nation and the world. The William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, online at wtgrantfoundation.org. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. Maharishi Mahesh Yogi, the Eastern spiritual leader who introduced Transcendental Meditation, or TM, to the world, died earlier this month at the age of 91. The Maharishi first visited the U.S. in the late 50s, but it wasn't until 1968 that major media outlets paid close attention to his message of self-improvement. It was on February 16th, 40 years ago this weekend, that John Lennon and George Harrison traveled to India to study with the master.
Far from the noise and pace of city life, in the cool, clear air of Rishikesh, North India, Pathy News reports from the meditation retreat of Maharishi Mahesh Yogi, the man who, through transcendental meditation, is currently bringing peace of mind to the Beatles.
John and George were soon joined by Paul and Ringo, leading the New York Times to observe, somewhat archly, that all four Beatles are now settled in a retreat by the Ganges that their globe-trotting guru maintains for those who follow him in pursuit of absolute bliss consciousness.
This spiritual life is not dependent on the renunciation of the world. It's only dependent on morning and evening practice of meditation, which can open to us the great reservoir of intelligence and energy and bliss consciousness.
The Maharishi and the Beatles quickly attracted an entourage, what the Los Angeles Times called a gaggle of pop stars, including the musician Donovan and actress Mia Farrow. It was the ultimate photo op. And then it was over, quite abruptly and amid controversy. But not before the Beatles found their muse, says New York Times music critic Alan Kozin. Alan, welcome to the show.
Hi, Brooke. Thanks.
So before we go to February 1968, take us back to 1967. What had the Beatles been doing that year, and how were they as a band creatively?
Well, they spent most of the year recording Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band. And creatively, from one point of view, they were really at their peak. I mean, Sgt. Pepper was an amazing album that had them doing all kinds of things with orchestras and psychedelic imagery and lyrics and electronic sound and that kind of thing. But they were also, certainly Lennon at any rate, was beginning to sort of lose interest in the idea of being in a band.
He was a little tapped out.
Yeah, he was a little tapped out. I mean, he came to those sessions with Strawberry Fields, which was then released as a single, and A Day in the Life, which was an extraordinary piece of music. But eventually he began to lose interest. And so for the rest of his songs, apart from maybe Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds, he was doing things like turning cornflakes commercials into songs.
Nothing to say, but what a day. How's your boy been? Nothing to do, it's up to you. I've got nothing to say, but it's okay.
Good morning, good morning, good morning, yeah.
And Being for the Benefit of Mr. Kite is basically taken right off a circus poster that he had on the wall of his house. And he said in interviews that he wrote these things really just to sort of keep up with Paul so that Paul wouldn't have all the songs on the album. they sort of had run out of the large stock of back catalog songs that they had at the very beginning of their career.
And it was just a couple of months after Sgt. Pepper was released that the Beatles first encountered the Maharishi. It was George Harrison's wife, Patty, who heard him speak, and eventually the other Beatles were drawn in. What was it about his teachings that was so attractive to the Beatles?
Well, first of all, George and Patty were both interested in Indian culture as it was, because he was beginning to play the sitar for couple of years by then, actually, and ran into information about TM and felt that it was going to show them what they were already trying to find through LSD, a door to the sort of subconscious and reality that you can't perceive with your normal senses. They felt that TM would do this without the drugs, particularly since Lennon was, by his own account, eating LSD for breakfast, lunch, and dinner most days by then. And so George got interested in something. He was sufficiently interested in it that they came along with him at the end of August 1967 to a retreat in Bangor, Wales. That's when Brian Epstein died while they were away at that retreat. And Maharishi sort of helped them through that crisis by giving them some Hindu philosophy about the soul continuing on after the body dies.
And so 40 years ago this weekend, the Beatles flew to Rishikesh, India to study with the Maharishi. Set the scene.
They went to India. Ringo Starr had a very delicate stomach. I mean, he was very sick as a kid, and there were sort of limitations on what he could eat, and spicy Indian food wasn't on the list.
The food was impossible for me because, you know, I'm allergic to so many different things. I took two suitcases with me, one of clothes and one of Heinz beans. There's a plug for you.
And when he ran out of those by the end of the first week, he decided that he really wasn't able to stay anymore. But the rest of them, you know, went to the lectures every day and meditated for hours on end. John would lock himself in a room and meditate for the afternoon. And then, you know, they had their guitars with them. They started writing songs and got a lot done.
You know, there was a lot of things that was actually stuff the Maharishi had said, like that song, Come On, Come On, you know, Come On, It's Such a Joy. Everybody got something to hide except for me and my monkey. Apart from the bit about the monkey, that was just what Maharishi used to always say, you know.
At some point, the Beatles had a falling out with the Maharishi. This had something to do with a guy they called Magic Alex.
Magic Alex was this character named Alexis Mardas, who had sort of glommed onto the Beatles and persuaded them that he was able to do incredible inventions, you know, cars that could fly, and he was going to build them a 72-track recording studio, and he started. He put a console in there with 72 inputs. It just wasn't attached to anything. But in the meantime, you know, the Beatles were setting up their own company, Apple. They set up this Apple Electronics division that Magic Alex was in charge of, and he went with them to India. Apparently, he felt that his position in the Beatles' inner circle was being threatened by all the attention that they were giving to the Maharishi.
And so he acted like Iago and planted poisonous seeds in the minds of the Beatles.
Yes, he did do this little Iago thing where he told them that the Maharishi had made unwanted advances to one of the women in the course. It's often said to be Mia Farrow, but sometimes it's ascribed to someone else as well, and it's not absolutely clear who it is.
And John was particularly vocal about his disaffection, and it came out later in a song, Sexy Sadie, which was originally called Maharishi.
That's right. Maharishi, what have you done? You made a fool of everyone. George persuaded him that that probably wasn't a good idea.
I said, you can't say that. You know, this is ridiculous. So I came up with the title of Sexy Sadie, and John changed it to Sexy Sadie.
Sexy Sadie, what have you done? You made a fool of everyone. Sexy Sadie, oh.
even though George ultimately, at the time, believed the story and also decided to leave with John, he did have his doubts, and he did think that what the Maharishi was teaching was valuable, and he felt that he should be treated with more respect than that.
And yet you've said that under the influence of transcendental meditation, the Beatles entered one of their most prolific and creative periods.
Once they congregated again in London after they were all back, they got together at George Harrison's house in May 1968, a couple of weeks before they started work on what became the White Album. And they just sat down and did demos for something like 27 songs that we know of, and we don't even know that we've heard the whole tape. It's incredible what they came up with, because the White Album has 30 songs on it. These 27 songs on the demo made at George's house include a number of songs that didn't get onto the White Album, but did turn up later, either as solo tracks like Paul McCartney's Junk or John Lennon's Child of Nature, which he rewrote as Jealous Guy.
I was feeling insecure.
Songs like George Harrison's Circles, which he didn't record till 1982, Sour Milk Sea, which he gave to someone else, Jackie Lomax, to make a single with.
You were a very young teenager when the Beatles traveled to India, right?
Right. I was, I think, 14 or 13.
And a rabid Beatles fan?
Yeah.
So did you feel you needed to get into the Maharishi too?
Well, you know, like a lot of people who followed them closely, it sort of was important to us to try and understand what the Beatles were up to. After they went to Rishikesh, books by the Maharishi began appearing in paperback. And so I bought one and actually tried to read it. I didn't get very far. My experience was very brief.
Nevertheless, you would consider the Beatles the ultimate celebrity endorsement?
Oh, undoubtedly. But, you know, the thing is that the Maharishi continued on until the time of his death, and he had many adherents, celebrated and otherwise. I mean, lots of people meditate to this day. And if it was just the Beatles that made him interesting, then after their 7 months of involvement with him was over, he would have just disappeared. So obviously there was something there that affected a lot of people and does to this day.
Alan, thank you so much.
Anytime.
Alan Kozin is a music critic for the New York Times.
Did you think this man's on the level?
I don't know what level he's on, but we had a nice holiday in India and came back rested.
The peace symbol is 50 years old. I'm talking about the circle with the lines inside that look like a headless stick figure with splayed legs. You can doodle it on your notebook, iron it on your tie-dyed T-shirt, spray paint it on a wall, and everyone knows it means peace. Columbia professor Todd Gitlin says the sign made its debut on February 21st, 1958, in a British anti-nuclear march. But how did that assortment of lines in a circle come to mean peace?
It was a semaphore signal. It was a code that stood for the two letters joined N and D for nuclear disarmament. It was adopted as a symbol by a British group called the Campaign for Nuclear Disarmament. And then it made the Great Migration over the water and was picked up by American pacifists and then in turn adapted by people who were almost pacifists or not quite pacifists in the early 1960s in a group called the Student Peace Union. And then it was just lying around as a kind of graphic gesture that was available for adaptation by anti-Vietnam War people.
It also seemed to eventually embrace far more than nuclear disarmament itself. It was imported to the States, I believe, by Bayard Rustin in the 60s, and it was embraced by the civil rights movement as kind of a universal symbol for civil disobedience and social justice.
Well, Bayard Rustin would have been the right importer because he came out of the radical pacifist movement. He was active in the group called the Fellowship of Reconciliation. He comes into the civil rights fight as a bearer of that tradition, and they are the real Gandhians. So there's a direct link from people like him to Martin Luther King and people around the civil rights movement, the early freedom riders. Many of them were drawn from that world. So it reflects that phase of the civil rights movement that was committed to active nonviolence. And in that sense, the peace symbol stood for their total ideology.
It's interesting to me that it not only has thrived for so long and endured, but that it made an impact to begin with, because based strictly on design criteria, it doesn't seem all that fetching to me. And at first glance, seems to send out the wrong message. I mean, I see a B-52 or maybe, you know, a chicken's footprint. How did this particular symbol capture the imagination of activists worldwide?
Actually, funny you should mention the chicken's footprint, because pro-Vietnam War people in the late 60s actually liked to attach that label to it. Say, ah, this is the footprint of the chicken who's, to mix the metaphor, running away with his tail between his leg and so on. Sort of nervous Nellies, as Lyndon Johnson used to say. But it might be, and I'm not a I don't consult for the branding people, but it might be the very simplicity and blandness of the symbol that made it so easily adaptable. There was a long period when people were putting it on jewelry and so on without any idea of its prior associations. I mean, I remember seeing kids in the 70s wearing charms of this shape and asking them what it was, and they didn't know.
Thank you very, very much.
My pleasure.
Todd Gitlin is a professor of journalism and sociology at Columbia University. The peace sign is an emblem celebrating its 50th anniversary and joins me by phone from the state of Washington. Peace sign, happy birthday.
Thanks.
I must say, the first time I ever noticed you, I thought you looked like a chicken footprint.
I get that a lot. Then people start with the clucking.
Does that make you...
Block, anti-war chicken, coward chicken, anti-war chicken, you know, that kind of baloney.
Now, of course, there's another peace sign, the two fingers raised in a V.
Yeah, the backwards Churchill.
Exactly, the V for victory in reverse. Now, that's also managed to span a couple of generations. Is there any rivalry between you and the fingers?
Oh, my God, no, no. We have a lot of history, and I still love them to death. You know, we haven't seen each other lately, but that's just because, you know, life sort of takes over. I'm in Seattle now to be closer to my grandkids, and he's got a little hip-hop on me, you know, peace out.
Now another of your contemporaries, I guess you're maybe 2 or 3 years older, but do you know the smiley face?
Yeah, I know him.
Well, did you two ever hang out together or, you know, try to combine forces or whatever, like synergize in some way?
I don't talk about smiley face.
Well, it just seems that, you know, you're both fundamentally optimistic characters at a time when world events...
Next question.
No, it's just that...
Next question.
Well, peace sign, it's been a fascinating half century, an amazing journey for you with Vietnam and the Cold War, the fall of the Soviet Union, loose nukes. Anything stand out most for you?
Remember Peter, Paul, and Mary?
Yeah, of course.
Mary.
That's gross. Peace sign. Thank you.
Whatever.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Megan Ryan, Jamie York, Mike Volo, Mark Phillips, and Nazanin Rafsanjani, and edited by Brooke. We had technical direction from Jennifer Munson and more engineering help from Paul Schneider. We also had help from Nadia Zonis, Sasha Evans, and as the peace symbol, David Fields. Our webmaster is Amy Pearl.
Katya Rogers is our senior producer, and John Keefe, our executive producer.
Bassist-composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. You can listen to the program and find free transcripts, MP3 downloads, and our podcast at onthemedia.org. You can also post comments there and email us at onthemedia@wnyc.org. This is On the Media from WNYC. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for On the Media is provided by the Bidell Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, the John and Anna Maria Phillips Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC. This is NPR.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.